This is episode 104 of the Osteopathic Manipulative Medicine Podcast, where we share clinical stories and pearls related to osteopathic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ben Green, a third-year ONMM resident at Michigan State University. Last week at our yearly convocation in Colorado Springs, I had the great honor and privilege to sit down with Drs. Yvonne Yang and Ed Stiles to speak about Dr. Stiles' lived experience of osteopathic history. I have to thank Dr. Yang for making this podcast episode happen and helping us preserve these stories not recorded in any books, as far as I know. Enjoy our conversation as Dr. Stiles recounts pivotal moments in osteopathic history, which he experienced with some of the great osteopaths of his lifetime.
So I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm Dr. Yvonne Yang. I did my OMM NM residency at Pikeville with Dr. Stiles from 2020 to 22. I was his last resident, and right now I'm working at an osteopathic medical school. So the motivation for this whole historical piece kind of came in bits and pieces, my curiosity over the years. At last year's pre-convo course, we had the pleasure of all teaching a sequencing course together with all of the different generations of stylized former residents and fellows of Dr. Stiles. And in observing them, I realized that everyone kind of interpreted things slightly differently. Some people explicitly explained things, and other people more intuitively just performed things. And it made me realize that so much of teaching and learning is actually nonverbal and not written anywhere. Then as faculty, I had an experience observing how the way we teach the seated flexion tests by Fred Mitchell Sr., as he wrote in his last article, was not how Dr. Stiles taught me, who had been working with Fred Mitchell Sr. Significantly, especially towards the end of his life, where he had expanded and fine-tuned all of his techniques and his approaches and his thought process. So I realized there was some gap that was missing.
Are we going to get into that?
Yes, that is exactly what we're going to get into. So yeah. Then OMM is now, I realized OMM was really just better taught through...
President calling you?
No. SHE still. SHE still. Said you're taking my name in vain.
But anyway, so getting back, so through those two experiences, I realized that OMM, like true osteopathic medicine at its heart, is passed down as a palpatory experience. And it's passed down through these different mentorship lineages that probably span different geographical areas, because back then we didn't have as easy transportation and communication. And that a lot of it is actually not in any formalized place in our profession. It's not written anywhere. It's not published in research. It's just passed down through these lineages. So I wanted to, and also Dr. Stiles, as you'll come to hear, has amazing stories where, because he's lived more than half of the profession. And I, as a resident, when I was learning, I heard the stories, and he told me the stories more so to teach a basic principle. But in connecting the stories and seeing the gaps between them, I realized those gaps were significant as far as understanding our history, who we are as osteopathic physicians, what our true identity was, and how we're almost rediscovering a lost identity as a profession as a whole. And where that might, what that might indicate as far as the gaps in public awareness, the gaps in clinical research or research in general in our profession, as well as the gaps in formal curriculum, possibly. And what we, if everyone knew that information, how inspirational and motivational it might be, because it was extremely motivational for me. So anyway, that's kind of what I wanted to, why I started putting all of this together. And every time I asked him a question, I had another, oh, what does this mean for like the greatness of our profession? And it is so great clinically. We all experience it, but there's just not that awareness out there in the world, especially in the medical community.
So, see, and that tied a lot of pieces together for me that I had just never really thought about. You know,
Yvonne asking
the
questions.
Yeah, because they were like isolated events that just were part of my career. And just had never really saw how this influenced this, and this influenced this, and this influenced this. And so it was really an eye-opener for me, too.
Yeah, so I'm just going to lay down a timeline for everyone following on the podcast. So A.T. Still, he passed away in 1917. And at that point in time, why don't actually you tell us about where the profession was at that point and then shortly after? What modalities existed?
Well, my understanding of the profession really started in 1961. And in that time, when at Kirksville, the only thing, and there were only five schools, 15,000 DOs in the country. Mm-hmm. The only thing that were taught in the schools were high velocity articular techniques and soft tissue techniques. Because muscle energy, strain, counter strain, facilitated position, really, all these, they hadn't been developed yet.
So you said HVLA, what were the other ones?
Articular techniques and soft tissue techniques. And then I got to Kirksville as being a pharmaceutical rep. And that convinced me I wanted to become a DO. So I went there wanting to learn manipulation and was frustrated with the way it was taught, and I started a study group. And then we went to various staff members and said, we understand you're a surgeon, internist, and do OMT, would you help us? And then they said, you're interested, you need to get to know George Laughlin. Yeah. He was Still's grandson. And that's how I got to meet Laughlin.
So we're going to get there. Yeah. Just want to lay a little bit of context for everyone else who, didn't know, as I didn't know. After H.C. Still passed, whatever he was doing got lost to the profession shortly after, such that only a few direct modalities existed and were passed on. And why is that? We kind of are experiencing that now, this passing down through mentorship lineages, not necessarily written. Even if it's written, it's not necessarily understood in the way that it was felt, right? 1948, so that was 1917. 1948, Fred Mitchell Sr. Can I interject?
Sorry,
please.
So those three modalities that you talked about, HVLA, articulatory, and soft tissue, were those modalities that Still taught, or were those the only modalities that he taught, or did we, like you were saying, did we lose everything, like the whole spectrum of Still's practice?
Okay, here's my bias.
It looks like he
did an awful lot of indirect techniques, in very gentle techniques, the stuff that I'm teaching now, that we finally figured out. But what I think happened was the family showed me pictures of Kirksville and Still in his heyday. And this town was surrounded by farmland, was filled with tents, people coming in to have Still treat him. See, and I think the local people said, wow, this guy's got something. We better get into this. Yeah. And I think a lot of people got into it and didn't understand his concepts, didn't have the palpatory skills. And I think that's when high velocity came in. They were trying to compensate.
And we'll get to there. I still want to lay a little bit of context. So
yeah, you keep us on track.
Yeah. So 1948, this is, about 30 years later, Fred Mitchell Sr., he's developing the pelvic model. And we'll go through that story at some point. But this was essentially his first publication on muscle energy. It didn't exist before then, right?
Mm-hmm.
1949, Sutherland has an early cranial course.
Yep.
And that's where he meets Laughlin, that's where Laughlin comes into the picture. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about that timeline.
So what happened was he did his it wasn't one of his first cranial course, but it was an early one. And a lot of the big names, the Beckers, the Magoons, the Kimberleys, the Schoolies, they were all in George Laughlin, the Lippincotts and everything. And that's when George really hooked up with Sutherland. And at the end of the course, Sutherland appointed him as chair of the technique committee to do the non-cranial techniques that were all indirect. It was basically BLT. But George said his uncle taught him that still did a lot of treating sitting up with people sitting on tables. And George put together BLT and sitting position, and that's what he put together and role modeled for me for 20 years. So that had all been lost, I think.
And then the other part that I think is a really important story to tell is Fred Mitchell Sr.'s motivation for coming into the profession.
Yeah. So Fred Jr. was a young kid. His Halloween costume caught on fire. And he's got severe skin grafts, a large part of his body. And this was in the late 20s, so 30s, early 30s. And he went into renal failure. And they came to the family and said, your son's going to die. Because you didn't have renal dialysis and all that. Mm-hmm. And Fred's wife knew Owens, who was Chapman's son-in-law or brother-in-law or something. And she said, I want him to see Fred. And the MDs in Chattanooga said, no way is a DO coming into this hospital. And Fred Sr. was tall and lanky and had a hair trigger temper. And he said, look, you just told me my son's going to die. And if he dies and you don't let him in, there's going to be more than one death. And so they let Chapman come in, and Chapman comes in and says, I want a glass of water with a teaspoon of salt and half a teaspoon of salt, because you didn't have IVs and a lot of that, and give it to him. They said, he's NPO, and they said, give it to him, he'll even sips. And he started treating the Chapman's reflex to the kidney. And after about 20 minutes, Fred started urinating and came out of it and lived. Well, his father says, hey, I'm a mechanical engineer. This looks mechanical. I'm going to become a DO. So he worked for a year selling cars to pay his son's hospital bill and spent time with Owens. And he was the living expert in Chapman's reflexes when in the 70s. And what did everybody say? Chapman's reflexes, don't do them until you balance the pelvis. And Kimberly told me, she said, everybody said, balance the pelvis. And you said to him, how do you do it? Nobody could explain it. That's why Mitchell spent all those years trying to explain the pelvis.
And so that's where the Mitchell model comes from, and that whole pelvic model, that came out in 1948. That was his first publication, written, you know, in the history, everyone's aware. So then we move into, you know, about 10 years later, Fred Mitchell Sr. is developing this pelvic model. He's developing MET, and he publishes his second publication.
And that one, he had all the findings for the sacral diagnoses. He had the Sphinx test, the spring test. He had leg length stuff. He had tied in what the lumbars were doing, the anomalies were doing. And all the techniques were muscle energy, whereas in his article 10 years earlier, all the techniques were high velocity for treating the sacrum.
So there's this progression, right? And this happens in 1958, right? And that's his last written publication.
I have so many questions about that. I don't know how detailed we want to get.
Yeah, well, we want to meet what you, because no, we want to meet what you're, because have you have the understanding? Because it's fascinating.
Yeah.
See, and so then my hypothesis is he realized that writing articles wasn't getting anything done. And he would lecture.
Mitchell Sr.
And he would lecture on muscle energy, but they didn't have practice time. So nobody was learning it. And a Dr. Sutton in Iowa said to him, Fred, you need to do.
We're going to get there.
got him to expand it. And out of that came a tutorial. And I think that was his third article. Because he realized if I mentor people, then this stuff will spread.
Which came later on. So in the spirit of the chronology and understanding, you know, what happened and the gaps in history, the next thing that happened throughout the profession was you started med school in 1961 at Kirksville, and that's where you met Laughlin. So I think it would be worth talking a little bit about who George Andrew Laughlin was.
His mother was Blanche Still, who was Still's youngest daughter. And his father was George Mark Laughlin, who was in the class of 1900. And he had to be quite a dude, because the month before he graduated, he married Still's daughter. And a month later, after graduating, Still appointed him a dean. And he was dean for 10 years. So they were George Laughlin's parents. And then his uncle Charlie, they all fed into him what his grandfather was doing. And was all the sitting up gentle, and now we would say all indirect functional techniques. So I was exposed to that in 61. Nobody was teaching it. But every time a class was canceled or Saturday mornings he was in his office, I was in his office. And I learned, but he couldn't describe it. All he could say was, and it was good right brain description. He said, take the dude into where it wants to go and fiddle and diddle. Well, now we would say, put it in the positional diagnosis and fine tune it till you get that joint as relaxed as possible. And if there are any axes involved, you're getting them involved. Then put a compression force in. So I had a whole different perspective as a first year student watching Laughlin treat these people.
And then I think it's also worth mentioning, you know, how he was kind of a recluse and didn't really ever publish anything.
Yeah. And he didn't have anything to do with school. He was a real loner. And I thought, this stuff can't get lost. I got to try to figure out a way of how to describe it and how to explain it. And so that was the projective of my career.
I mean, the grandson of Still, living in the same town as the first osteopathic medical school, you would think that he would be at least like a guest lecturer, go and teach some labs to the students.
Nope.
Why is that? What happened?
Because everybody was high velocity. They thought he was, you couldn't possibly do anything that gently. And he did cranial. And in those days, the profession didn't want us to talk about cranial because we were trying to get accepted by the medical profession. Mm-hmm. So he was really a problem, a thorn in their side, that he could do everything really gently. See, and where Mitchell turned everything upside down, he said to people, I've got a new way of treating people, and you don't have to use a physician thrust. You use a patient muscle effort, specific muscle effort, to reestablish normal motion. That turned the profession upside down.
Wow.
Because everybody was doing high velocity.
Okay.
So then currently in this time frame, I know I have the exact same
She recognizes reaction. The expression.
I know, I was there just a year or two before where I was like, wait, what? What? This can't be, right? So also during this whole time frame, I think it's worth kind of setting the context of what was out there in the profession and what was developing in the profession. So Fryatt's laws, the barrier concepts, things like that. Can you talk a little bit about the timeline of, you know, having a common language to describe what we did as a profession?
Yeah, because where I came to that was, you know, everybody knows that the flu epidemic of 1917, 18, 19 put the profession on the map. And everybody says this is what they did. Well, Boyd Boozer, when he was our dean, said, I want you to do a lecture on the new flu epidemic when it was coming down the road a few years ago. And I went back and looked at it. And I thought, all these things they were saying, they were doing at the time of the flu. Well, the Fryatt's laws weren't accepted until 1942. It was way after the flu epidemic. Mm-hmm. Nobody was talking about lymphatic pump at that time. The whole lymphatic pump stuff didn't come into the profession until like 28 to 30, somewhere in there. So what they were just doing is, I think, very gentle spinal techniques. They didn't have Fryatt's laws to explain what they were doing. They just knew that if they worked on those tissues and got it relaxed, the patients did better. Then I think it took years and years and years. People say, we got to try to describe that. And I think that's why Fryatt came up along, and that's why the lymphatic pump stuff all came along, was they were trying to explain what the hell they were doing and why they were getting the effect in 1917 and 18.
Yeah.
So they could feel it, but they didn't quite have words to describe, which is a common theme in our profession.
Absolutely.
Right? Even when you explain it to a patient and try and get their consent, they don't really know until after the treatment.
I think it'd be fascinating at some point to do a deep dive into how did Fryatt come up with his laws, the three laws. How?
Well,
and I don't know if we want to do that here.
Well,
we'll do it at a different time.
I know I can do it quickly right now. Because Kimberly and Mitchell helped me with that. They said Fryatt's laws are just two physics principles. Law one is, if you have a pile of blocks, and if you take a pile of blocks and move the top off the side, what do the blocks in the middle do? They float out. They they go out from under. And they said because of the anterior and posterior spinal ligaments, they can't do that. So they rotate out from under. So if you're in neutral and it involves all, that's type 1 mechanics. Well, then if you're in a little flexion or extension, now the facets are controlling the mechanics. Then it's acting like a long flexible ruler. And if you take a long flexible ruler and side bend it, the center of it rotates into the concavity. So side bending and rotation. So they just said Fryatt's laws were just two basic physics principles.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I mean, I don't want to...
I don't want to spend too much time on techniques and modalities, more just the history.
And we can talk about it another time.
Yeah.
But
I think that just made so much... And just boil... And today, when I explain Fryatt's laws to students like that, they go, that makes sense. I've just been memorizing all this. But you just gave me a mental picture of this. And this all makes sense.
Yeah. And I think moving forward, you know, we're talking about inspiring the next generation. Explanations like that for our medical students are so important.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than just memorizing the principles, understand the why.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to talk about was the barrier concepts and how they didn't exist and when they came into the profession, because it would kind of explain why people had difficulty describing what they were actually doing.
So the first time I heard the barrier concept was in 1970, so this was 5 years after I graduated. And Mitchell, in his first tutorial, talked about the anatomical barriers and the elastic barriers and the physiological barriers and the restrictive barriers and how you could go direct and indirect. And I go, oh my God, Laughlin's going indirect. And so within a couple of months after that tutorial, I went back to Kirksville and drew that diagram out and said, George, are you going indirect? He said, oh yeah, yeah, that's what I'm doing. But once in a while, you got to go direct. And so that's when I really started to appreciate what the heck he was doing.
And this is also a common theme between mentors and who they teach, is the confusion of the learners is what brings the awareness to the mentors of something that they might not necessarily explicitly realize that they're doing.
Yeah.
And so they're not saying it or teaching it, but the learner is observing and not getting the same results, so they're trying to figure out what they're missing.
It would be really interesting to have these, put the modalities that we teach in medical school into historical context, like in a textbook.
Because and then in around 1970, Larry Jones was just beginning to really talk about his strain counter strain. And Shiawitz was beginning to talk about facilitated position. But they were in isolation. And you know, it wasn't until the 70s that they had convocations. So people weren't getting together every year. They were doing their thing in their own and coming up with their own terminology. And they didn't mix. And it just caused a lot of confusion.
Because prior to that, there weren't all... We didn't have a common language. We didn't have these common concepts to describe what we were feeling that was similar or different than someone else. So there was no common language, one. And the other thing is communication was difficult back then. We didn't have social media, email, you know, all these things. And what Dr. Stiles brought up to me, I didn't realize back then, with the first convocation, commercial flights were not really a thing like they are today, you know. So getting everyone in one location to actually be in person and treat and feel was hugely more difficult in that time frame.
See, in the first convocation was, I think, in 1971. And I didn't go, it was held in Fort Worth because the movers and the shakers in the academy at that time were all out of Texas.
I see.
Then the second one, I think was in 72, was held here at the Broadmoor. And it was in the old golf club that they torn down. It was upstairs in the golf club. And I walked in because Mitchell was going to be here, and I'd spent a year and a half now learning muscle energy and stuff. And I walk in, and people said, oh, we're so glad to have you here because we're the academy and we're the conscience of the profession. How many DOs do you think were at that convocation?
Less than 100.
35. and the average age was about 70, and I'm thinking, this is the future of the profession. I don't know.
How old were you at that time? You were a young whippersnapper.
Yeah, so I was like 30.
You were the future.
Yeah.
Exactly.
See, and then in 68, I took over Perrin Wilson's practice in Boston. He was a big mover and shaker. And that was a godsend because everybody wanted to know who's this young whippersnapper that took over Wilson's practice. So everybody, I had to meet all the big names in the profession real early in my career.
And that actually kind of set you up for 1970, the first muscle energy tutorial?
Yep. How that happened, it was interesting, because when I took over Wilson's practice, I thought, I'm crazy as hell, because I've been in practice for 3 years doing general practice with some OMT, and I'm taking over a practice of a guy that's been at it for 50 years, big name high velocity person, and I do very little high velocity. Mm-hmm. And when I took over his practice, it was interesting because he just wanted somebody to take it over. They didn't have any children. He was well off financially. He just wanted somebody to come in and take care of his patients. So he sold me his practice, his McManus table, for $1.
Wait, his practice?
And his McManus table for $1.
$1
for tax purposes.
Wow.
And
deal.
But he had a set of the Academy yearbooks that I had never seen. And I was going through those because I was thinking, man, I got to start reading to catch up to try to take over this practice. Mm-hmm. And I found the 48 article on muscle energy. So I went to him and I said, hey, can you help me with this muscle energy stuff? And he said, no, I can't. Because he said, Fred was developing it at the end of my career, and I was pleased with the results I was getting. I never learned it, but he said, I'd highly recommend you learn it. And are you going to be at the AOA convention this year? And I said, yes. He said, okay, I'll introduce you to Fred. So the meeting was in New York, and I walked into the lobby of the hotel and I saw Wilson talking to him. And he said, oh, there's Fred over there. Let's go over. So he said, this is Ed Stiles. You took over my practice. And I said, Dr. Mitchell, I've been reading your 48 article, and I've got more questions than I've got answers. And if at all possible during this 5-day meeting or 4-day meeting, whatever, I'd love to have some time with you. And he said, stand right there and don't move. And he disappeared. About 10 minutes later, he came back with his son and somebody else I've never been able to remember. He took me up to his hotel room. And 5.5 hours later, I got out of there. He answered all my questions. He answered questions I didn't even know to ask. He gave me a quick brief down on muscle energy. He treated me. And it was the first time I ever heard somebody say, here's this joint, and it does this, 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 and this. And if you palpate here, this, this, and this. And if it doesn't do this, you use this muscle. And if it does this, it was bing. He had the thing, bing, 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 bing. And I thought, so I followed him like a puppy dog the rest of that convention. And I've jokingly said, if he went into the men's room, I went into the men's room. Because I was afraid there'd be a door, he'd go out, and I'd lose him. And people were saying, Fred, would you treat me? And I was watching him and everything. Yeah. And I spent all my time with him during that thing. And then about 6 months later, one day I get a call on my reception, say, this is Dr. Mitchell on the phone, wants to talk to you. He said, this is Fred Mitchell Sr. Are you the Ed Stiles that spent time with me in New York at the OA? And I said, yeah. He said, Dr. Sutton's convinced me I've got to do a 6-day or 5-day course. Mm-hmm. Limited to 6 people, and if you want one of the spots, you've got it. I said, you tell me where and when I'll be there. But it was out of that chance meeting in New York that really changed my whole paradigm.
Yeah, that's neat. I mean, getting the practice from Perrin Wilson kind of set you up to meet the big leaders in the profession, and then met Fred Mitchell and got invited to that very exclusive course, the energy course, yeah.
The power of mentorship.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And chance.
Yeah. I think something in our profession that we've talked about, and you mentioned, Yvonne, was what we're palpating, figuring out ways to measure what we're feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, because I think the passing on your clinical experience and what you're palpating is important verbally. But to, I think, make that next leap where the MDs validate what we're doing, it seems to me that we need more objective measures.
We will get there towards the end.
And I know you've got some research. So we're
still in 1970s right now. Yeah. That comes in 2020 and after. Okay. So we will circle back to that. So I think it'd be really
see, and neat. then all yeah. then the Larry, no, well, the Larry Joneses and people, they knew I spent time with Laughlin,
yeah,
and that he was doing indirect. So that opened all the doors to me to the indirect people.
Yeah. Okay. Got both sides of the coin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Direct and indirect.
Yeah.
So I think it would be worth talking about that first muscle energy tutorial, because a lot of people don't realize how it came about,
yeah,
what happened there, and how close it came to being lost to the profession.
Well, Sally Sutton put us up at her house, and she had neighbors come in and cook and clean. We didn't get out of that house for 6 days. I mean, we were cloistered.
And who was there? And set it up.
It was Phil Greenman, John Goodrich, Roland Miller, Sally Sutton, me, and there was a gal named Dee Nowlin. And she was a good friend of Sally Sutton's, and she knew her from Des Moines. But she had just finished an internship and was starting a practice, and Fred picked right up on it. She was exhausted when she got there. So the first morning, doing demonstration, Fred said, come up here, Dee, let me give you an overview of what I do, muscle. He treated her out. She slept for 3 days. He had her out, and we were down to five. And then and it was amazing how he taught and just stressed principle after principle, then a lot of applications of the principles and how you could do it in different ways and things. Mm-hmm. And then the sixth day, we had to treat patients of Sally Sutton's in front of Fred. So he wanted to see if we'd learned anything. Mm-hmm. Then that night was the first night we got out of the house. We went out to dinner. And Fred said, stood up after dinner and said, I'm really excited because I think you people are beginning to get this. And he said, I made the decision on the plane coming in that if you didn't learn it this week, I was never going to talk about muscle energy again. It came that close to getting lost.
Interesting. Why such a tiny group? Why didn't he open it up to, why didn't he have the tutorial at the AOA convocation?
Because they weren't having convocations then.
This was in 1970, the first AOA.
Was it 71?
71.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How come you didn't wait a year?
Because they didn't know. I don't think they even knew they were going to have a convo. Mm. I think he was smart in knowing it would be better to get a small group.
Small little group.
That was and get them to understand and then let them spread it.
I see.
Yeah, I think he picked up on that one.
Got it.
Because then over the next several years, Phil Greenman, Fred Jr., Kimberly, and myself, we taught muscle energy all over the United States, all over Europe, yeah. And that's how, and the thing it came, and the other part of that story is interesting. The week after Greenman got home after the course, a doctor called him and said, hey, I'm an MD from the Netherlands. I do manual medicine. I understand you. Can I spend the week with you? So what do you think Phil's going to teach him? Muscle energy. The guy said, this is amazing because the best manipulator in Europe is Carl Levitt, and he's a prisoner of the communists in Prague. Mm. And he needs to know this. And this guy's name was Gaiman. And within 2 weeks, Gaiman got in behind the Iron Curtain, taught it to Levitt. And so from almost being lost to 2 weeks later, it was international.
That's incredible. I mean, Mitchell Sr. must have been an incredible instructor.
Oh!
Because, you know, you're all intellectuals. I can see you all saying, well, why are you doing this and why are you doing that? And he must have been so good at his knowledge of anatomy and, like you were saying,
well, joint motion. He was a mechanical engineer.
Yeah.
See, and I think that just made so much sense to him.
Yeah.
And he stressed principles. And then gave you many ways. And the thing I loved about him, he said, if you learn the principles and learn how to adapt the technique to the patient's unique anatomy. He said, my goal for you is to gain mastery. I don't want just competency. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, he was so far ahead of his time.
And that's wild, though. In 6 days, that's not a lot of time.
No.
That he was able to convince you to the point where maybe, like with Dr. Greenman, I mean, that seemed to be his bread and butter.
Oh, yeah.
After and that.
We were roommates. That's when we first met.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, to this day, because of that course at Michigan State University, what we learn primarily is muscle energy technique.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's, yeah.
But he started teaching as soon as he woke up in the morning, lectured all during breakfast, all during the morning, all during lunch, wow, all during the afternoon, all time. And we'd finally get to bed about 10 o'clock and he'd say, well, I think I got to get some sleep. And then Phil and I'd be saying, what the heck is going on? This is amazing what this guy is doing. Really? The way he's teaching, this is profound. Phil leaned over to me and said, we need to spend more time not just learning his techniques, learning how he teaches, because he's an unbelievable teacher.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
The power of a good mentor and good teacher. That's not just reiterating something that they heard, but they believe it, they know it to the core.
And because he worked it out and spent years and years working that out.
Yeah. And one thing you mentioned about him, why he was such a great teacher, is because he never just said he did something because he did it. He always had an explanation.
And he never said, this is right and wrong. Like in the first morning, I raised my hand and I said, Dr. Mitchell, I'm having trouble wrapping my head around this muscle energy stuff. And he said, because my whole training at Kirsten was high velocity. I said, well, yeah, I've had 8 years of experience with Laughlin, but I'm just having trouble that a muscle effort can make this much of a change. And he never said, well, you're right or wrong, and this is it. He said, Stiles, you've forgotten the definition of work. And I said, okay, what do you mean? And he said, work is force times time. And this was he always gave you an example. He said, if you want to move a refrigerator, you can run up against it and hit it. You just bounce back. It doesn't move. But if you lean against it for several seconds, you can move it. So he said, a small muscle energy effort over several seconds will produce far more corrective force than a high velocity force for a nanosecond. I mean, that was a paradigm shift for me.
Interesting. That's really interesting. Waldman's book, I forget the name of his book, on manual medicine, joint mechanics, talks about making the greatest change by treating the deepest structure.
Yeah.
You know?
See, and I think today we'd call that the area of greatest restriction, the key lesion.
Okay.
Which we'll get to.
No, but to give you another example. So one of the first techniques in the thoracic area, he's using the head and neck.
Yeah.
And I raised my hand. I said, Dr. Mitchell, I'm having trouble with this because I was taught in Kirksville. See, and I thought he went to Chicago. I went to Mecca, you know.
Yeah, sure.
I said, I'm having trouble with it. You can use the neck down to T5. He said, Stiles, come up here. And he had somebody sit in the table. And he said, you palpate L5. And he had the patient slump and translate to get it to L. And he just moved the neck a little bit, and I could feel L5. He said, really? If you use translation, you can get all the way down to L5. Well, God, there was another paradigm shift. Yeah. See, and he didn't say that's right or that's wrong. He just would say, now let me show you another way of thinking about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was always how he taught.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
I think one really, something that I've gleaned from all the time spending with you talking about Fred Mitchell Sr. is he explains how he fine-tunes.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas most people just say, oh, you fine-tune. Well, what does that mean? How does that feel like as a student or a newer DO? It's not so obvious, but he explains how to fine-tune, and you feel the difference when he does it, you know, without fine-tuning, which gets you some of the way, and then when you fine-tune, it gets you so much.
And the example better. Would be when I did the muscle energy Zoom meeting with you guys and talk about the left-on-left torsion and said he always had a finger on either side of the posterior superior spine or the medial side because he was palpating the medial axis, and when he lowered the legs, he did it slowly until he felt that the middle turned into the left oblique. That's when he had them push up, whereas most people would go right down past that, and that's why they don't get a good result with that technique.
Because if you're going to apply that force that during that whole time, you want it to be as precise as possible without any, you know, restriction in the way in the rest of the whole tensegrity system.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I wish we had like sensors we could put on the body so you're lowering the leg and say, oh, there it is, hold it.
Yeah.
You know. Well, we do.
The best ones in the world.
We do.
Our hands.
We're
going
to get to the objective measures.
Yeah.
We will get there. I promise. We will get there.
Yeah.
So that first muscle energy tutorial essentially was his third publication, Fred Mitchell Sr.
That's what I believe. That he decided, I'm not writing a third article. This is my third article. But he never wrote down or published what he said in that first tutorial.
Which means from 1958, there was all he figured out from 1958 on, including what he figured out after that first tutorial,
has never been. Up until he died in 74, was all up in his head.
And what he shared with
us. And what I saw with him helping him teach tutorials, because after he did the first one, a lot of people in the profession said, you need to start doing more tutorials. And so he would always take one of the six of us or one of the five of us with him. And I helped him teach three, I think.
Three then, of how many?
I think he did seven or eight. Yeah.
Tutorials, muscle energy.
Five-day tutorials, yep, like the first one.
How often did you do it, a year?
So from 70 to he died in like March or January of 74. So 70, 71, 70. So for 4 years, he probably did one or two a year maybe the most.
Okay.
And some years may not. And see, and then people went to him, Larry Jones, and said, Larry, the people are learning muscle energy because of these five-day tutorials. You need to. That's when Larry Jones started doing five-day tutorials. Yeah.
When did the Academy say, okay, muscle energy, we believe it. This is a valid treatment technique.
Were you at the FAO discussion Wednesday night?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay, there were three speakers from Chicago.
Yeah,
talking about the sacrum and what did they spend a lot of their time doing? Ripping muscle energy in the pelvis. So, it in a lot of areas it hasn't been accepted yet. But that says to me it's becoming more and more prominent in the profession, and that's really riling up the Chicago people.
And that is a common theme.
The second thing Mitchell told us that night that he made the decision he wouldn't teach it again, he said, I want to just warn you, for the rest of your career, you're going to catch all sorts of flack from DOs because you studied with me and learned muscle energy and didn't depend on a thrust. And when I was sitting there hearing that Wednesday night, I said, here it is. I'm still living it.
Really? But it seems like what Perrin Wilson told you, he was great at HVLA.
Oh, yeah.
But he was open to muscle energy. I feel there's a lot of DOs that they just get really good at a technique, and that becomes like theirs.
Well, what was interesting was when I took over Wilson's practice, he was 80. And I ran that practice for 5 years. And during 68, 69 in there, I think, Wilson said to me, you understand my verbiage now and how I look at things. Mm-hmm. I taught him muscle energy and functional.
Oh, you did. And that's good. He was open to learning. Oh, yeah. I think that's really important.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The best practitioners at some point realize if they're missing something, they're going to want to keep digging on, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, when I went down to the interview with him, he said this Saturday morning, he said, I want you to treat a patient for me. She's a type 2 diabetic. She's got a frozen shoulder. It's been going on for months. I'm having a lot of trouble with her, and I want you to treat her. Yeah. So I thought, I'm not going to do high velocity, compete with him. I'll do functional. Well, I treated her functionally with Laughlin stuff. I got through, and he said, well, that was interesting, but he said, you know, something like that, you really got to get in there and really start moving around. And that functional stuff is good, but you got to get in there. And I said, well, you've got the reputation. I don't.
Yeah.
Well, the next morning, the woman calls the doctor and says, who was that doctor with me yesterday? He said, Dr. Stiles. Why? She said, my shoulder's a lot better. And he told me that story.
Yeah.
And he said, boy, I need to have you teach me what Laughlin's doing.
Yeah. That's great.
I mean, beautiful. It comes full circle.
I have another question, but...
No, go.
Do you want to keep moving forward? So I feel like with what we do, the work that we do, I think there's the component of, like, the buy-in. For example, athletes, they want to be racked and cracked. And if they don't feel the pop, it's like you didn't do a darn thing. You know? So...
Here's a famous Kimberly quote for him. Kimberly said, skilled high velocity should be both painless and noiseless.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Because he said, many times all you're popping are the hypermobile joints around it.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. I'll have to tell my PD that one.
Which I have found to be true as a patient, you know. Okay. It makes sense.
But most of those real good high-velocity people, they didn't go for the pop. They would treat them, but then they'd recheck to make sure they made a change. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the pop, they said most of the time when I treat them, they don't pop.
Yeah.
But I've effectively got them going.
Gosh, you're giving me more confidence with my HVLA.
I know, same. I felt the same way. And now I have to do very little force to get it.
Oh, yeah, like fine-tuning.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's the key. That is the key. And using translation.
Yeah, the force
and then,
is minimal.
And Mitchell was the first one that talked about facets in spinal mechanics. And if you palpate the dysfunctional facet pair and localize your forces there and get that joint as relaxed as possible, then find the right vector. I mean, it takes very little force, just very little. And one of Wilson's famous quotes was, the amount of force used in high velocity is inversely proportional to the operator's understanding of the problem.
Wow.
I love that.
We need to have like a chiropractor and Dr. Stiles, you know, have a conversation. That would be interesting.
That would be interesting. We definitely should.
one other thing though we probably should say is
go for it.
No, but going back to the 60s.
Oh, really?
The guy that had a profound effect on me was Irving Kaur, the physiologist in the profession.
Okay.
We got real close. And he had a profound effect on my osteopathic thinking.
How so?
Because he, the first one was, he said, you know, when you're looking at a patient, you have two components of that patient. You have a host component and a disease component. And he said, and think about it, the musculoskeletal system, and that's what you're really focusing on is DOs. It's totally useless without a functional nervous system. So he said, therefore, the neuromusculoskeletal system is the primary machinery of life that you carry out the activities of daily living. He says, the viscera are the secondary machinery. He said, now the allopathic profession thinks the viscera are the primary machinery and the musculoskeletal system is the secondary, but it's the other way around. And the job of the secondary machinery is to meet the demands of the primary machinery. And when it's working like mad, it's got to work like mad. When it's quieted down, it's quieted down. Well, that changed how I always looked at patients from the standpoint. When I walk in the room, I'm looking at, yeah, they got a secondary problems. But is it secondary to primary mechanism problems? And he just had all sorts of things like that. That he was the first one that came up with the concept of facilitation.
And muscle facilitation.
Yeah. Or, you know, well, so he said somatic dysfunction can either stimulate or inhibit the nerves at that level of the cord. See, and now they usually say somatic dysfunction stimulates it. And Kaur said, no, lots of times it can inhibit.
Did he come up... I don't, yeah, I guess it's a he, come up with the idea of the arthrokinematic reflex, where the mechanoreceptors in the joint capsule send afferent signals back to the spinal cord, like a reflex arm, and then efferents come back out to stimulate, facilitate, or inhibit muscles around that joint.
He and Denslow, that was their early research. See, and he was hired by the Rockefeller Foundation to go investigate osteopathy. Because John D. Jr. Rockefeller, the last 10 years of his life, was treated every Wednesday by Parenteau Wilson. So they wanted to give money to the profession, but they weren't too sure about this profession. Yeah. So they hired Kaur, who was a big-name physiologist, young, upcoming physiologist, to go to Kirksville for a year to investigate it. And they turned Kaur upside down, and the whole rest of his career was devoted to osteopathy.
Did you treat the Rockefellers?
No.
You did not?
No.
And one thing to piggyback off what you said, I think as a younger learner, osteopathic physician, student, whenever you read A.T. Still's philosophical books, he talks a lot about like how disease processes are predisposed by these slight strains and twists in the body. And when you're coming from the allopathic model, it really is hard to comprehend that paradigm shift because you're like, how could a little strain predispose me right. to cancer, you know? But a little bit of strain over 20, 30 years and having that like slightly less optimized dysfunctional organ function over time could actually predispose you to developing certain chronic diseases. And that was a huge shift for me.
Yeah.
And I think something that, you know, is difficult for DOs to understand in our current medical.
See, and what
Cora
would say is, so somatic dysfunction of the musculoskeletal system, it could stimulate or inhibit the sympathetics. That could affect the vagusmotor supply. So it could affect circulation all over the body. Then it could affect sympathetic motor and either stimulate or inhibit it. Somatic dysfunction could stimulate or inhibit the parasympathetic. Mm-hmm. And then if you have somatic dysfunction that's affecting the rib cage, that can affect ventilation, venous, lymphatic circulation. So he said, what I want you to, when you go into the room, is to ask yourself, why is this patient having this problem now? Why didn't they have it a month ago, 6 months ago, a year ago? Mm-hmm. What's going on now? What hindrances came into their life that could have affected all of those factors, any of them or any combination, lowered their resistance, increased their susceptibility? So then you'll be able to understand their clinical picture. That if you don't have that model, you couldn't come up with the answer.
I agree. I mean, I think it's so clear for us who live in this field that optimizing the normal function of the musculoskeletal system is going to optimize health.
Exactly.
See,
but I feel like we need, I don't know, because I haven't read the plethora of all the literature, the osteopathic literature, but
that's probably
like
a good thing you haven't.
Part of the podcast this year is to talk about some of the research.
Oh, no.
But it seems like it would be good to do like a longitudinal study.
Oh, yeah.
With a like a cohort study where you have one group who is receiving OMT over a decade and looking at their chronic pain or disease, chronic disease, and another cohort group over 10 years and looking and comparing and contrasting chronic disease.
That would
or
be
functional
lovely.
Scores, you know, because that would give us some data to say what we're saying.
Her article is the basis for that.
Is.
That she just had published. I mean, that.
Yeah. We need to talk
we'll,
about
we'll
that
get
later.
There. That's at the end. I'm trying to keep people excited.
So the other thing about Core is he was the first one that came up with the concept of neurotrophic flow, of the trophins that are produced in the nucleus of the nerve. And they can't get to the end organ except by coursing down the axon. And he called it neurotrophic flow. And that came out of a, I heard the discussion, out of a discussion with George Laughlin. And Core said, Laughlin said to Core, Kim asked me, because he was Irving M. Core, but he switched the letters around and went by Kim. And George said, Kim, I see some patients that have muscle atrophy. Mm-hmm. And it's not like it's a neurological thing. And lots of times, after I get these patients mechanically functional, then the muscle tone and size restores. What the hell's going on? And Core started thinking about it, set up a research project, and found it was lots of times it was the flow of those trophins. And those trophins were bringing healing factors, growth factors, all sorts of neurotransmitters.
Yeah.
And they've shown that I think it's 30 millimeters of mercury pressure on a nerve can impede that flow of trophins to the end organ. Well, that was all Core.
Really?
And he told me afterwards, he was told indirectly that because he was at Kirksville, if in an osteopathic school, if he hadn't been, he would have won the Nobel Prize for his trophin work.
Really?
he was way ahead of his time. Mm. But it flowed out of that, his osteopathic thinking. He thought more osteopathically than most DOs. He was an amazing guy.
Yeah. I'm going to have to read about that.
Oh,
trophin flow.
I think that is so important. And most schools don't talk about it at all.
Where can you find that research?
The best place is the Core yearbooks. They did two volumes of Core's published papers.
Yeah. Okay.
And what's interesting of those, he called me when they did the first one. He said, they want a chapter on my contribution clinically. And he said, I'm not a clinician. I don't think that should be true. And I said, whoa, wait a minute, Kim. Let me list about 10 things that I do every day that's based on concepts I learned from you. And he said, whoa, would you write the article? So he had me write the preface for the first one. Mm-hmm. Then the second one, he said, would you write the second one? And I didn't explain what the impact he had, I think, on the profession clinically and stuff. And he called me and he said, want to thank you for that. He said, I cried when I read that with joy. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. But he was a neat, he just had a profound effect on me.
Yeah, that's neat. I'm going to have to read that.
Mm.
Yeah, but he's just an amazing contributor to our profession. And and we'll talk about the core symposium later on. So that's okay. Part of it. But moving us right along. So now we're at 1970s.
Yep.
And so to step back, basically Fred Mitchell Sr. gave the profession a common language and understanding to communicate.
And diagnoses.
And diagnoses.
The explanation diagnoses, yeah.
And then the next thing to happen chronologically is 1973 Waterville.
I thought 1970, when Phil and I hooked up and roomed together, then he was going to go back and become academic dean at the New Michigan State School. And he said, I want you to join me and you teach the OMT stuff. So for several years, I thought I was going to Michigan State and we had planned on doing it. And I couldn't sell, I had my practice in Boston, Wilson's practice. I moved it into we had a house and office combination, and the house was built in 1693. Well, you can imagine trying to sell a house that built in 1693 with a physician's office attached to it, okay? And we're having trouble. And I called Phil and I said, I don't think I'm gonna be able to make it. And he said, no, your offer's open. Forever. So then Waterville called me and said, well, I had interned there and worked there as a Pfizer rep and everything and externed there in summers. And they said, we understand you're going to move to Michigan. And I said, yeah, why don't you come back up here and start a hospital? Let's start a hospital-based OMT service. And I called Phil and I said, you know, nobody's had a chance to do that. I think you don't need me. You got Greenman and you've got Goodrich and you've got Hoover and you've got Beale and you've got you know, all the names you get up there, you don't need me, I'm going to Maine. And that was so beautiful because in 1970, that wasn't even on the scene. See, and like Mitchell said, when you're doing the first rib techniques, everybody puts the arm up like that, right? If the ribs are caught down and then have them push up against it. And Mitchell said, and this was his teaching skill, he said, but what are you gonna do if that patient has a frozen shoulder? Wonder if that arm's been amputated. Are you going to say, when the arm grows back, you come back and I'll fix that? But he said, what's the principle? You're trying to functionally change the origin insertion. Why couldn't you reach underneath and get the posterior angle of that first rib? Then just put your hand on the head and say to the patient, take a deep breath, hold it. Now push your head up and into my hand. Then he'd say, have them turn a little right and left to see which one really kicks in the sclenoids. See, and then he said, then you could do this for pec minor, that you could do the same thing. And so that prepared me for bringing all muscle energy into the intensive care unit, 1973. Yeah. And it was all that data in the Medicare computers that we got the code numbers.
Right.
So he really set the stage for that.
And that was the first inpatient OMT service in the country.
A full-time. Because some of the schools had hospital program, but they weren't full-time hospital work.
So Wednesday night, I remember, they were saying, we got the codes from...
Let me tell you the rest of the
story. And I was like, wait, Dr. Stiles told me that in Waterville, Maine, you... were a big part of establishing the osteopathic codes.
Now, the way they phrased it was right. Okay?
Okay.
Here's the rest of the story. Then when you should ask Habeneck or Judith O'Connell and say, what year did you get the code numbers into CPT? It was in the 80s. Okay. I got the original codes with Medicare that then went to the whole insurance industry in 1974. So I got the code numbers. Now, they did get them into CPT.
Okay.
But I was the one that got, and it was all based on my dad and the Medicare computers. They said, you're saving us money. What the hell are you doing?
I'm Do they know that? I wonder.
They came to him. They were like, "What are you doing?"
Yeah, they called me.
Oh, did they?
They said a lot of your cardiologists, well, most of them were internists in those days, not cardiologists even yet. And they said, when we see the, I figured it out, I don't know how, that Medicare only deal with the top five diagnoses. Mm-hmm. So I said, if I do a consult for you and I treat the patient, make sure that somatic dysfunction is in one of the top five. So then Medicare called me and said, hey, what's this diagnosis, somatic dysfunction? And I explained it to him. And I said, why are you interested? And they said, you're saving us a lot of money. And I said, what are you talking about? And they said, well, the patients that come into your intensive care unit and have a diagnosis of somatic dysfunction, they're discharged a lot quicker, have far less medication, far less workups, far less readmissions and everything. What the heck is going on? But it was, they picked it up on their, in their computer data.
Tell the story of how you guys negotiated.
Well, to make a long story short, they said, what can I do for you? And I said, well, you just told me I'm saving you one hell of a lot of money, and I'm not getting paid for what I do, or the hospital isn't getting paid for what I do, because we don't have code numbers. So I need code numbers. So we worked out a way of negotiating them, and so we started that hospital program in August of 73, okay. And in July of 74, we had code numbers, the five-level coding system.
The five-level coding system, like the 992-1314-0304.
Yep.
So then what did Dr. O'Connell do?
So then they got accepted by CPT.
Okay. And CPT, remind me what that stands for.
So it's the common, it's the big MD book on hospital or therapeutic codes.
Got it. Okay.
So that was the first time they had accepted it into CPT. Now, it was accepted by Medicare, and then once I got it in Maine, all the other states were saying, what the hell's going on? Medicare is a federal program, and Stiles is getting paid for OMT, and we're not, so it spread like wildfire.
Sure.
Well, then the federal government got upset. They fired the CEO that gave me the code numbers.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, they were mad because he gave the osteopathic profession code numbers.
Wow.
Unsung hero.
Yeah, who is that person?
Yeah. See, and then the insurance companies, whatever Medicare did, they did. So then the insurance companies picked it up. See, so then people were getting paid for it, but it wasn't into CPT yet. So that's what O'Connell and Boozer did.
Incredible. That's an interesting story.
So they should get the credit for that.
Yeah.
But if you ask them, but were there any code numbers before that set the stage for that? Because see, if I did that in 74, I'll bet you that didn't get into CPT until 85, 86, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. So it was at least 10 years the DOs were paid by that five-level coding system with Medicare and a lot of insurance companies. And then once Medicare accepted it, then a lot of the other insurance companies picked up on it.
Yeah. We should find out who that CEO was in Waterville. I mean, that's like permission, you know, type story.
Mm.
But that's huge for our profession,
yes.
Right? I mean, we wouldn't be able to have a living.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And help so many people.
Let me tell you the rest of the story. So I'm sitting in the, because I had a good friend, Harry Aldridge, had a twin-engine Aztec. And he used to like to fly me all over the place when I was lecturing, because he needed flying hours. So he flew me down to Portland, Maine for this meeting, because they said, we want you to come in and present to Medicare, all the staff, of what osteopathy is all about. So I went and did my anatomical and physiological basis. And I got all through, and the guy said, that was fascinating. Come into my office. And I told my wife, I said, if I disappear off the face of the earth, good place to start looking is Medicare. And he shut the door, and he said, look, I'm an MD internist.
Yeah.
I practiced in Portland, Maine for 30 years. I hated DOs. But you're really talking about saving us money, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And so he said, well, what can I do? And I said, well, we need code numbers. He said, oh, okay, well, what have you got? And we weren't going to tell him. He said, we've got a basic one, but we need to do a little fine-tuning. Could we have a room and a phone and make some calls? He said, sure. So I called the AOA, and the executive director at that time was Ed Kroll, who had been an internist at Waterville, and I'd known a long time. And I said, Ed, I'm in Medicare. I can get codes, get paid for OMT. He said, don't do it, don't do it. I said, what do you mean don't do it? He said, don't do it. I said, why? And he said, because we, our messages, we're DOs, we do differently, we do a lot of OMT, and if it isn't reflected in the data, we're going to look bad. I said, Ed, maybe they're not doing a lot because they're not getting paid. Maybe if I get code numbers, there'll be a lot more OMT done.
Yeah.
But the AOA didn't want me to do it. And I said, well, we're separating here.
Wait, I still don't understand why Ed Crow didn't want you to get the codes.
Well, because the profession was saying DOs are different from MDs and DOs manipulate.
Sure.
Well, if they found out that just a small percentage of the DOs were manipulating, that blew their blew their message.
And it's the same problem now, because that study that came out a couple years ago that showed, I can't remember the exact percentage, but it was an abysmal percentage of DOs that actually do any manipulation.
Yeah. Mm.
And of that percentage, it was even smaller that do it on a regular basis and have, like, you know, a majority of their practice. So it's really, I mean, and this is part of our public, you know, our public image, is most people assume that all DOs do it and all DOs do it well. But the reality is that very few.
Well, from 74, the next two or three convocations, they were all held here. I caught a lot of flack from a lot of DOs saying, you shouldn't have done that. Shouldn't have done that. Because what DOs did, they said, we provide our patient care, primary care, but we include the OMT into it, and we don't bill for the OMT. We just bill for the office visit.
Yeah, well, thank you for doing that, because I think putting a monetary value on it also shows there is a value to what we're doing.
Oh, yeah.
And a difference, an osteopathic difference.
Right.
See, and that was the first time the federal government really acknowledged there was something different about osteopathy.
Yeah. And I think that could be a whole other podcast, and it should be, you know, why are less, I think the number that comes to mind is like less than 5% of DOs are actually using OMT. Like, why is that? You know, that's a whole other podcast, but I think we should have that discussion at some point.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But see, what was so neat about it is we were just trying to provide the pay, because there were three hospitals in Waterville, two MD and one DO. And in those days, the government, both federal and state, were trying to push all these hospitals into a merger. But if you could show certification to need that you were doing something unique, they couldn't force you to merge. So that's why they hired me. I was trying to save that hospital's existence.
Yeah,
and we were just trying to provide care. That was all. And when the whole thing came up about Medicare saying, you're saving stuff, we were going, holy mackerel, we didn't realize we were doing this for a year. Mm-hmm. We were just trying to provide our patients good osteopathic care.
Yeah. And that's just 1 year's data.
Yeah.
Just one.
How much money did you save the hospital system?
I don't know. I never.
Enough to get a call.
Because that's so valuable. Like, if we could take those numbers and the patients that came through that hospital and go to other big hospital systems and talk about that. That's very convincing. Yeah. Every hospital wants to save money.
Well, see, that's where CORE helped me, because the host disease illness thing. Because, see, what I was saying to the staff is, look, I'm not going to be criticizing or talking about your medical care. That's you're treating the disease. I'm treating the host. And if we put both those together, we ought to get a synergistic effect.
Yeah.
See, and then that sold the staff on it, because I'd say, I found this dysfunction, and I think this played a role in this clinical case, and I found this, and this could do this, and this could. So the consults were like, each one was an individual osteopathic educational session. And our staff came around. Some of them that were real skepticals came around. We had staff members move into Waterville from all over the country saying, we want to come here so our patients that are hospitalized can get OMT.
And that, I think, is important if we, you know, take a step back and understand that AT still was an MD first and originally tried to bring it into the MD profession. They wouldn't allow it. He saw it as the missing piece that was completing medicine. He only started it separately because they wouldn't allow him to help them complete it. So it was always meant to be a completion of medicine, a synergy with the rest of the medical, you know, institution, not a replacement.
Sure. You know, and the other thing that was interesting, because when I left to go to Waterville, Wilson wrote me a very, he was an unbelievable gentleman, perfect like gentleman. But man, he ripped into me that I was abandoning his practice and abandoning his patients and what were they going to do? And this would never work in the hospital environment like that and everything. And Laughlin's grandson shared a letter with me from Wilson to George Laughlin telling this story that I was leaving. But then a year later, he wrote me a letter and said, because a lot of publications came out in the DO and the journal, American Osteopathic Journal and stuff about Waterville and what we were doing and some of the data we're getting. And Perrin wrote me a letter and said, I owe you an apology. You made the right decision. And
I mean, good for you, Dr. Stiles, because that's, you were following what you thought was the right path, sometimes without support.
Yeah,
a lot of times.
Well, Greenman wasn't very real supportive of me getting the code numbers.
Yeah.
He goes, I don't know if that's going to be good or not.
It's important. That's an important, I think, just life principle.
Yeah.
You know, to follow what you believe to be right.
Yeah.
No matter what other people say.
Yeah.
You know, thank you for doing that.
Well,
but that Waterville never would have taken place if it hadn't been for Laughlin, the functional techniques, and then how Mitchell, in a way, prepared my mind to adapt the muscle energy techniques to the hospital patient.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Well, can we?
Well, I want to get to the sequencing thing, but I think maybe we should take a quick break.
Okay.
Because that's a good long story.
Break. No, but one other thing, where we're off camera, then I could do. Is the other?
We're not off camera.
But you know, because so you have the big picture. The other thing that happened that in Boston that was so neat, in Boston, the licensure is same board, so they don't know whether you're keep track of whether you're an MD or DO. Everybody gets the same license. So right after I took over Wilson's practice, I get a postcard. And it says, every Thursday night at the Brigham, which is Harvard's main teaching hospital, there'll be a lecture series going on for residents getting prepared for boards. And if you want to attend, you're welcome to attend. So I thought, oh, man, I can go over there and hear all the hot shots at Harvard and Tufts and BU and Dartmouth and everything. Whoa. Yeah. And the first night, the guy was talking about pulmonary disease. And he had residents with him, and he had a big blackboard and all sorts of stuff on it. He got all through and he turned around and he said, do you want to know what I think about that? And somebody said, yeah. And he said, 85% of pulmonary problems are a problem of ventilation, and that's a function of the musculoskeletal system. And I went, whoa. And I raised my hand, and they didn't know whether you're an MD. I said, that was a fascinating statement you just made, that 85% of pulmonary problems are a problem of ventilation. It's a problem of the musculoskeletal system. What do you do about it if the musculoskeletal system isn't working right? He said, that's a very interesting question. He said, I'll tell you what we're doing right now is we've got an old iron lung over at the Brigham, and we found if we put people in that and intermittently put pressure on their chest, they get better. And what I found is going to those things for 5 years, they were masters at boiling things down to a basic principle. But then lots of times they didn't know how to apply it. And I could think, oh, I could do this, this, and this osteopathically. And listening to that 5 years and all the different diseases and everything, that prepared me for doing the consults in Waterville.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder where that number comes from, 85% of...
But this would have been like 68, 69.
Yeah, yeah. Because we need data like that.
Oh, yeah.
We need that.
Oh, yeah.
We need that.
But see, all of those sessions, those discussions could come back, and I could use that information in consults. Yeah. It was beautiful preparation.
Yeah. I mean, Yvonne made a really
From the good, disease side.
Yvonne made a really good point about how Still wanted the OMT to be complementary to
synergistic
what was already...
Too.
Synergistic.
Yeah.
Synergistic. Completing the whole of what we understood of medicine. And that's like a good example, right? Because the allopaths, they got the data, but if 85% of lung disease is coming from a lack of ventilation,
well, he was talking about COPD that night.
Then what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's where our profession, our specialty comes in.
Yep.
But hopefully more will practice this. But, even MDs.
But so much of that, I think, was... I think our profession has done a terrible job of packaging and marketing. And I got that from Pfizer. And that's been my whole career. How can I package this differently and market it differently in a way? Because George Laughlin used to say, my grandfather's goal was not to have a separate profession, but he had to because the MDs wouldn't accept him. Mm-hmm. But his whole mission was to expand the practice of medicine.
And I'll say this for all the younger, you know, med students and people interested who don't really know how to talk about OMM to their allopathic counterparts. I mean, the way you summarize those questions to ask yourself is such a beautiful way to present it to the rest of the healthcare profession in a way that's like non-threatening and really synergistic and a team effort. So it's asking, is somatic dysfunction present? Is it correlated with their clinical presentation directly or indirectly? And I tell my students, 90% of the time it's directly correlated. The rest, it's indirectly correlated. So it's correlated, basically. And then what is the realm of reversibility? You don't necessarily know it, but, you know, if someone has end-stage fibrosis or, you know, a 9-year-old with severe scoliosis all their lives, maybe not going to get that much reversibility, but you actually... you get a sense of expectation setting for both the patient and you. And then, so those three questions, and then there was one more. Now I'm blanking.
Well, you know, when I really realized how important it was to package and market it, was in 76, the AMA, with the federal government, came up with a big book, the 700 Most Common Hospital Diagnoses. And what criteria had to be met for that to be that patient to be accepted, and then for what that criteria needed to be for them to get reimbursed, okay. And so the profession got the federal gave the AOA like $150,000, and in 77 that was a lot of money, and they said we want you to put osteopathic criteria into some of these diagnoses. So the AOA called me, Kroll called me and said, hey, would you work with the specialty groups? And so I worked with the different specialty groups and meeting in Washington and doing this. Well, that was a fun thing. And we ended up with, I think, 150 diagnoses that we put osteopathic criteria. That was the good news. The bad news was it had to be defended before a representative of the AMA and HEW at that time. So it was human... What's it called now? It was Health Education Welfare. It's Human Resources or something now. Okay. Well, man, so I had to present it, the case, and I was sweating bullets, man. So I got up, and the first time I said, let's talk about asthma. And so a lot of times those patients, I'll find cervical and some cranial-based stuff that can be stimulating the vagus and cause bronchiolitis. And I can find some upper thoracic or upper rib dysfunction that could be inhibiting the sympathetics, and therefore they get better than a normal parasympathetic can really cause problems. But if this parasympathetic was stimulated and the sympathetic was inhibited, could you really have a problem? And that may be why lots of times the sympathetic mimetic drugs don't work, because it's driven by the parasympathetic. And then I'd want to know the rib cage working right so they can ventilate properly and get good venous. And I did congestive heart failure, and then I started in on, I think it was peptic ulcer. And the vice president for the AMA at that time was there. He stood up, and his face was red, and his neck veins were sticking out. And he said, he didn't point at me, he said, I can't argue with one thing you're saying. Would your profession please get the data to support it? And he turned to the feds and HEW and said, publish it. And that was the first document that was ever published that had osteopathic criteria in it. And I found, because if I used, I realized if I used osteopathic lingo to describe what we were doing, we were going nowhere. But he said, anatomically and physiologically, I can't argue with one thing you're saying. And I thought, here, I'm like, my early 40s or something, and anatomically and physiologically, I just got the AMA to say, let the federal government publish this osteopathic stuff. Yeah. I thought, what is our potential?
Yeah. Was anything ever published?
Oh, yeah. This is a published document. It's a big, thick book.
Really? Because is that part of the foundations where they talk about, there's a chapter in foundations that's about hospital OMT.
Yeah, but that I had no input into that.
No. Because it seemed like what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. I think the one they had do that more was Hugh Ettlinger.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we're going to have a conversation with him in a couple of days. Cool. So I remember the last thing.
Because, I was the black sheep in a way because of muscle energy.
Yes, that's why the chronology is important to understand where things
that
fit in.
Crazy voodoo functional indirect stuff. So I had a lot of strikes against me.
Yeah. But you were true to your beliefs.
Yeah.
True to your passion, true to the profession. You can get up and go. I just wanted to summarize the last point that you made for me that was important as a new osteopath. So, is somatic dysfunction present? Does it correlate directly or indirectly to their clinical presentation? Is it within the realm of reversibility?
Yep.
And that will, if they're all yes, 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 and the third one is plus or minus, then OMT is indicated. You're going to do it.
Yep.
But you still don't know the patient's health potential.
Yep.
Because it's individualized for the patient. It's not a population-based thing that's retrospective. So you could have someone who has somatic dysfunction correlating, and it doesn't seem reversible, and you treat them, and you still don't know if the somatic dysfunction is playing 10% role or 90% role. Mm-hmm. Only the treatment response will tell you.
Yep.
And if you say that to an MD and you don't promise to, bring world peace before, but you're very humble about the fact that it has to be something that you glean that data point afterwards, then you can go back and correlate clinically and say the somatic dysfunction was playing a big role or a small role or somewhere in between. And that's why it is so synergistic with the rest of medicine, because you can, we had patients in during the pandemic who had COVID, all the same stories. Like, we had one patient who was young, who we thought we would get out. She had somatic dysfunction, but her somatic dysfunction was not playing a big role, and she was hospitalized for like a month. We had like a 55-year-old with all these comorbidities, and on paper she looked terrible. She had the same somatic dysfunction. She was discharged like a couple days after because her somatic dysfunction was playing like 80% role in her situation. So you don't know until after the fact. And if you present it that way, it helps MDs and other people understand the benefit of OMT in a realistic way.
Mm. Yeah. It makes for a hard sell, though, kind of, doesn't it?
No, it makes for an easier sell because you're being humble and you're explaining everything based on anatomy and physiology. And when you say it that way, then you're not promising to cure end-stage cancer necessarily with OMT. You're very pragmatic and thoughtful and educated, rational, rational about your thought process. And I had a lot of MD preceptors in residency who had no idea what we were doing. And if I presented it that way, then they were very open. Mm-hmm. And when they saw one incident, if it helped, then they knew that it was playing a big role. If it didn't, then I talked to them why it wasn't.
And then we weren't criticizing medical allopathic care.
Yeah. I could see that humble approach helping, definitely. Because you can't say, I know this is going to help them out.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Because you don't. You're right.
I mean, even MDs don't know. Well, you can't do that allopathically. Yeah.
That's true. That's true. Even though they sell it like, this is going to help you for sure.
Yeah.
This pill that I'm going to give you. My question, though, with the direct and indirect, is the somatic dysfunction playing directly or indirectly into the chief complaint?
So
that's a tough question to answer, right?
I don't think you know until you treat them. Yeah. See, so if I walk into the room and the I've seen asthmatics, they're sitting in the hospital bed and they've done everything known to man at that time,
yeah,
treating them.
Yeah.
And then I find some upper cervical and treat it. And when I walk out of the room, they're laying down breathing normally. I think I can assume that somatic dysfunction was stimulating the vagus. Right.
The other
see,
thing,
so I think once you see the clinical response.
And the other thing that Dr. Stiles always did with me, which was helpful, is after you've found all the dysfunction and you've treated, then you, in your own body, just exaggerate all the dysfunctions and you'll be in a position where you'll be like, oh, wow, I can't breathe right now. Oh, wow, my back hurts right now. And then if you can correlate all the somato and visceral somatic and somato-visceral reflexes in your mind, then you can basically back correlate all your findings to explain their clinical presentation. And so that's like another way, you know, so you just, you find a somatic dysfunction, you're like, oh, well, that could correlate to their asthmatic exacerbation because of X, Y, and Z. And so you use the dysfunction in the anatomy that relates directly to the physiology based on all the reflexes and everything.
See, and lots of times with the asthmatic, I'd say this was mostly upper thoracic, and when I released it, the wheezing stopped immediately. Yeah. And that may have stimulated the sympathetics, but it may have also changed vasomotor tone, and maybe they had a good blood level medication, but not a good tissue level. Mm-hmm. And maybe now the drug started to get where it was supposed to go, and that's why they responded.
I like that approach. I'm going to start inpatient OMM literally Monday when I get
Yay! So needed. Yay. Yeah. That's amazing.
So, yeah. This is helpful.
Yeah. If you're near a minor, just call us later.
This is the end of part one of the osteopathic history with Ed Stiles and Yvonne Yang. You can find their emails in the show notes. Next week, we will finish up our conversation. Thanks for listening. As always, be well, be curious, and spread osteopathy.